control.
So last spring, we dealt with 1 Samuel. And if you remember the way that 1 Samuel was set up, we had stories about Samuel. I'm sort of reading Hebrew for you, so we'll start over here. So we had stories about... We do read that way, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Beautiful. We had stories about Samuel. We had stories about Samuel and Saul. Then we had stories about Saul and David. And we didn't read many of these. We mostly read about Samuel. As soon as you remember in chapter 16, this is 1 Samuel. Remember in chapter 16, as soon as Samuel shows up, as soon as David shows up, Samuel disappears. And so David doesn't have anything to do with Samuel. He simply has to do with Saul and David are sort of together. Throughout all of these stories, and just to, again, we're going to read the very last chapter, because it's kind of important for the first chapter of 2 Samuel. But throughout all of these stories, David has been anointed king by Samuel, by God's instruction. There's a problem, however. There's another king. This always causes problems. There was a big deal about this throughout, the Middle Ages, right? When you had sort of two kings vying for the same position. Saul is king, and yet David has been anointed king. I'm never sure that Saul actually ever really knows that David's been anointed king. Which kind of sets the stories in a bit different way. If Saul doesn't actually know it, if there's just this guy come along wanting to take over his position. But Saul and David sort of are, dealing with each other. At the very beginning, everybody loves David. Everybody loves David, including Saul. That relationship sours rather quickly. As soon as David starts getting more and more power and more people start loving David, Saul starts getting jealous. You remember, again, it's sort of set up like a tragedy, right? Where we start off in a very good place and we wind up in a very bad place. Saul starts getting jealous. He starts getting paranoid, more than jealous. He starts getting paranoid. He starts actually trying to kill David a couple of times. And David always sort of is able to get out of the situation. Throughout all of these stories, it's really a remarkable thing. And that is that anybody that stands against David, strange and unfortunate things happen to them. And we will see that continues throughout the first part of 2 Samuel as well. Eventually, by the very end of 1 Samuel, Saul dies. He dies in battle against the Philistines. And I'm going to read this. Again, it's not a long chapter, so again, I haven't printed it for you. This is just this is the thing that we read right before we read the chapter we're going to read today. Sound good?
Good.
Pay attention. I'm not just wasting time here, because you're going to have to remember. Does anybody have a memory like a goldfish? Okay, good, excellent. So you can all remember over a period of about 5 minutes, right? Beautiful, excellent. So remember this story that I'm about to tell you, because it's going to be really important for the story that we're going to read, okay? So don't fall asleep. When the Philistines attacked the Israelites, so they're at war, right, the Philistines and the Israelites. When the Philistines attacked the Israelites ran away from the Philistines. Well, that doesn't sound very good, does it? They ran away from the Philistines, and many fell dead on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and they killed his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The battle was fierce around Saul, and when the archers located him, they wounded him badly, right? And as I said, if you remember from that last class, dying by arrow is a horrible, horrible way to die because it's very protracted, because basically you just bleed out, right? So it's not immediate, and so it's like an ongoing, it's inevitable, but it's just a horrible, horrible way to die. But anyway, the archers found him, and they wounded him, and so he's bleeding out, right? Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and kill me with it." Otherwise, these uncircumcised, that is the Philistines, these uncircumcised men will come and kill me and then torture me. I would probably say torture me and then kill me, but he put it that way. Kill me, or torture me. But his armor bearer refused because he was terrified. And so Saul took the sword, his own sword, and impaled himself on it. And when the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also impaled himself on his sword and died with Saul. And so Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his soldiers died together on that day. When the Israelites across the valley and across the Jordan learned that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their towns and they fled. And so the Philistines came and occupied those towns. And the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons lying dead on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off Saul's head and they stripped his armor. And then they sent word throughout all the Philistine territory, carrying the good news to their gods' temples and to their people. Right? Because it's good news, because now their enemy king is dead, right? And they put Saul's armor in the temple of Astarte, their goddess, right? And hung his body on the wall of Beth Shean. So they sort of tack him up there on the wall, sort of to show, don't mess with the Philistines, right? This is what happens to people that mess with the Philistines. But when all the people of Jabesh-Gilead, right, which is an Israelite town, when the people of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, that is, cut him off, tacked up his body, the bravest of their men set out, and they traveled all night long, and they took the bodies of Saul and his sons off the wall of Beth-Shean, and then they went back to Jabesh, their hometown, and they burned them, right, they cremated them. And then they took their bones and they buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted for 7 days. And that's where 1 Samuel ends. Again, hear the good news, right? It's kind of like the gospel reading this morning, kind of unusual if you haven't been to church yet. But yeah, again, it's kind of a tragedy, the way in which 1 Samuel ends. Right? So, the death of Saul and his sons. Well, it seems as if everybody that stands against David eventually gets it in the end. I always think of this like Breaking Bad, if you know Breaking Bad. Right, I really do. I've been re-watching Breaking Bad. Anyway, you'll hear about Breaking Bad if you stick with this class for very long. But yeah, anybody that stands up against Walter White, right, it's just sort of eventually, usually winds up in a pot of acid, but that's not important right now. And so everybody sort of gets it, right, including Saul himself, including the king. So now, David's it. So far, so good. Don't forget what I just read. Let's see what we've got in the very next chapter. Ready? Here we go. I titled this The Aftermath of Saul's Death, because obviously, as soon as a king dies, right, or a royal or a ruler dies, right, it sort of causes agita, right? I don't know what to do, right? So, here we go. After Saul's death, when David had returned from defeating the Amalekites, so I guess he's fighting against the Amalekites, who aren't the Philistines, so he's fighting somebody else and he defeats them, he stays in Ziklag for 2 days. On the third day, a man showed up from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. All right, so let me ask you a question. So this guy shows up from Saul's camp. Again, 80% of teaching is stating what is self-evident, right? That's the reason why I get paid a tremendous amount of money for no work at all. So this guy shows up from Saul's camp. His clothes are torn, dirt on his head. What do we know about the guy?
He's in mourning,
that's right. Something bad has happened. Yeah. So far, so good? Okay, cool. So obviously, he's not, I don't know, skipping in with a tutu or something, right? Obviously, something is bad when he's come from Saul's camp. When he reached David, he fell to the ground, bowing low out of respect. "Where have you come from?" David asked him. "I've escaped from the Israelite army," he answered. "So what's the report?" David asked him. "Tell me." So he doesn't know, David, theoretically, doesn't know what's gone on, right? And so the man answered, The troops fled from the battle. Many of the soldiers have fallen and died. And what's more, Saul and his son Jonathan have also died. Okay, so let me ask you a question. Again, one, for me at least, and again, this is a footnote. One of the failures of our society is that we read fast. Right? I mean, remember, those of you of a certain age, remember the 1980s or so, there were all these courses on speed reading, right? And so you could get, like, Moby. I mean, I actually saw this dude on TV on some talk show or something that could take a novel, right? And within, like, 3 minutes, like, and the person could ask them, the host would ask them questions about certain characters, and they would know, right? And they hadn't read the book. So, you know, reading fast, and what? That's just wonderful. No, it's not wonderful. It's not wonderful at all. And so you'll just notice, again, if you stick with this class, so far I didn't understand why you might not. But anyway, if you stick with this class, one of the things that you'll notice that we do is just read slowly and just sort of stop every once in a while and just pay attention to what it's saying, right? So the guy says, so what's the report? The troops have fled from the battle. Is that true? Yes. Okay, cool. Many of the soldiers have fallen and died. Is that true?
Yep.
That's right. What's more, Saul and his son Jonathan have also died. Is that true?
Yep.
Yeah. Now, of course, there's also Abinadab and Malchishua, but we don't mention them. Okay. Cool. But Saul and his... So what he says is true. Beautiful. How do you know, David asked the young man who brought the news, that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? I'm sorry, just pause there. Just a question popped up in my head is, why is it so important for him to know? And that's kind of an ambiguous question. Right? But anyway, the young man who brought the news replied, I just happened to be on Mount Gilboa. And Saul was there, leaning on his spear, with chariots and horsemen closing in on him. Did we see this dude in the last chapter? No, okay. Unless he's, well, no, we didn't, right? Because everybody that we saw in the last chapter is dead. Yeah. I just happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and Saul was there, leaning on his spear with chariots and horsemen closing in on him. Well, that sounds like, right? He turned around and he saw me. And then he called to me. Yes, sir, I answered. Did we see this scene in the last chapter? No, we didn't see this scene. So did this actually happen?
No.
We don't know. That's really important. We don't know at this point whether this happened or not, right? Again, it's really important, right? Again, the Bible is not written for third graders, right? The Bible is written for adults. Just because the Bible tells us something that happened in the story, it doesn't mean it tells us everything that happened. So far, so good? Okay. Okay, maybe, right? So he's leaning on his spear, which sounds about right. Chariots and horsemen are closing in on him. Sounds about right. Yes, sir, I answered. Who are you? He asked, and I told him I'm an Amalekite. And he said to me, please come over here and kill me, because convulsions have come over me, but I'm still alive. And so I went over to him and killed him, because I knew that he couldn't survive after... Does this sound right?
Nope.
No, this is not what happened. Now he's saying something that... It doesn't matter how the story's being told. This did not happen. Remember, Saul... Again, I don't have to tell you what you remember, because hopefully you remember, right? Come over here and kill me, because convulsions have come over me, but I'm still alive. And so I went over and I killed him, because I knew he couldn't survive after being wounded like that. And I took the crown that was on his head... And the bracelet that was on his arm, right, armband that was on his arm. And I brought them here to you, my master. So far, so good?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to stop right now. So, is what the Amalekite, this young man, is saying, did that really happen?
No.
No, it did not happen, right? We just heard the story, right? And again, it wasn't a story in the mouth of somebody else. It was actually the narrator telling us what had happened. So far, so good? Okay, cool. This guy comes along and says about, oh my goodness. Again, I got a PhD from Yale in Old Testament, right? But it absolutely transformed. It transformed transformed the way I read the Bible. This was probably 17, 18 years ago. It absolutely transformed the way I read the Bible when I realized this. And here's my piece of advice for you if you want to like really enjoy the Bible, not just read it because you have to, but actually enjoy the Bible. And it's this piece of advice. People lie. And I don't know if you know that. All you have to do is watch TV and commercials for just about. It's like, we'll be sitting there and we'll watch TV or something. And as soon as the commercials come on, I start paying attention. My wife, as soon as the commercials come on, she starts doing something else. I actually watch commercials, and it's like I'm sitting there, and it's like the commercial says, blah, 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 whatever, whatever. And I'll say out loud, that doesn't even make any sense. Right? And she'll say, what? And I said, the commercial says, oh. So anyway, people lie all the time, right? In the story, when the narrator is telling us something, I trust that. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean that the narrator is telling us everything, but I trust it, right? And so when I read the last chapter about what actually happened to Saul and Jonathan and Malchishua, right, and Abinadab, that's what happened. This guy comes along and says, this is what happened. People lie. And so anytime anyone says anything, particularly when they say something about what happened in the past, my spidey sense goes off, right? I pay attention. So far, so good? Mm-hmm. Once you realize that, it's absolutely remarkable. Another footnote. It's important that in the Bible as a whole, one of the very first characters to speak in the whole Bible is a snake. Right? That should give us pause for every other character that speaks in the Bible. Right? So anyway, so that's right. Cool. So here's the question. So this guy has come and he is saying something that's not true. I went up, he called me over, he says, kill me. So I killed him because I knew he couldn't live much longer. Then I took the crown and I took his armband and I brought them here to you, my master. So far, so good? Why would the young guy, and again, this is where we have to, here's the second thing, and that is the only thing you can see with people is what they do, and the only thing you can hear from people is what they say. And we have to take those things and try to discern why. Why are they, again, even standing up here right now, I'm sure that there's more than three of you saying, why is he doing all this? why is he making a big deal? Let's just read, right? Right, we have to imply intention. So far, so good. By looking at what people do, by hearing what they say, particularly when we realize that sometimes people don't just say things because that's the way things are. Right? And sometimes people do things not just because that's who they are. Sometimes people, I don't know if you know this, sometimes people do things in order to be seen by other people, or so that you think that they're a nice person. Or sometimes it's because you think they want you to think they're a snappy dresser or something, right? So people do things for reasons. And sometimes those reasons are on the surface, and sometimes those reasons are down here. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, cool. Again, these are real characters, right? Why might the young man have come in and lied about the death of Saul, brought David Saul's crown and his armband, symbol of his power, crown and his armband, and given them to David? Why might he have lied? Why is he lying?
He's an Amalekite. He ingratiated himself to David.
Excellent. I have no idea what you said. No, exactly. But why? Why again? Somebody?
Yeah? Career advancement.
Huh? Career advancement? Beautiful. Yes? Right? It's funny because we're trying to look into his heart and trying to understand why he might be doing what he's doing. We do know he's lying. Yeah.
He's not an Israeli, though.
He's what? What?
He's not an Israeli.
Yeah.
He's not, that's right, exactly. He's not an Israelite. That's right. He's an outsider. Yeah.
Well, and didn't David just finish defeating his people?
Yeah. That's right. Exactly.
What was he doing on Mount Gilboa?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And if again, right, it may be that if David has just defeated his people, then maybe he's kind of afraid that David's wanting to him as well. And so he's trying to maybe get in his good graces. And it seems as though also, it seems to me, particularly with the story about Saul, and particularly with the gifts that he presents, that the man is thinking about David's intentions. For all of this time, from David's anointing as king, all through this time, Saul's been trying to kill him, trying to undermine him, trying to execute him, actually, right? Because David's a traitor, right, to the nation, right? Mm-hmm. All this time. And so one might wonder what David's feelings are about Saul. So far, so good? It may be that what the Amalekite thinks about David is that obviously, David hates Saul. And David can't wait for Saul to be out of the way. Therefore, he's going to do sort of double duty here, right? He's going to save his own life. And as well as maybe actually get career advancement, promoted, because, you're the one that's given me the chance to actually be king and forthrightly. Does all that make sense? Seems as though that would, sort of seeing that would explain why the young man is doing all of this. Well, I'm sure it's going to go well for him. And I brought them here to you, my master. And then David clicked his heels and said, yippee. No, he doesn't do that at all. Interestingly enough, David grabs his clothes and rips them. And then all his soldiers do the same. For me at least, that's an interesting sentence, because we're going to see this again. As soon as David does something, everybody around David does something. Nobody around David does anything all by themselves. They always pay attention to what David's doing. And then whatever David's doing is what they're going to do. So far, so good? And again, and that's just a tiny little thing, and again, you wouldn't get that here, but sort of pay attention to that in the stories that are coming up. David grabs his clothes, he rips them, all his soldiers rip theirs. They mourned, and they cried, and they fasted until the evening for Saul, his son Jonathan, the Lord's army, and the whole house of Israel, because they had died by the sword. Let's ask you a question. Pay attention. What does David feel about Saul's death?
Relief.
We don't know.
We don't know. I see what he's doing. I see how he tears his clothes. I see how he cries. I see how he mourns. And the word mourning here is actually, again, when I say the word mourn, and again, I hate people that used to do this when I didn't know Hebrew, but I'll go ahead and do it anyway. The word mourning for us means to be sad. So far, so good. But the word mourning in Hebrew simply means to do funeral type of things, right? So it means like wearing black, right? Or putting on a veil, or covering up all the clocks or mirrors or something. You know what I mean? It's the things that you do in light of a death. And so we see him do mourning types of things. We see him tearing his clothes. We see him crying. But it's really, really important that he could do those things for any number of reasons. And again, I'm just bringing this up now, not because of this. If you just read the story by itself, that's fine. But I'm just going to make you aware of things that are going to be coming up, just things to pay attention to. I don't know what David thinks about it very well. I would think it would be a relief, but it seems as though he's rather upset. And the important word in that little sentence that I just said is the word seems. So far, so good? Okay. How house of Israel, because they had died by the sword. Where are you from? David asked the young man who had brought up. They do all this stuff until the evening, right? So they fast. They don't have their dinner, right? They cry and all of this stuff. Where are you from? David asked the young man who brought him the news. I'm the son of an immigrant, an Amalekite. And then David said to him, how is it that you weren't afraid to raise your hand and destroy the Lord's anointed? And David called for one of his young servants. Come here. And he said, strike him down. Does that little scene right there, that little tiny scene, sound familiar? It's very close to what just happened with Saul in the previous chapter, remember? Mm-hmm. Saul calls his armor bearer over and he says, strike me down. And does the armor bearer do it?
Yes.
No, because he's afraid.
I thought he did.
Mm-hmm. No, strike me down, right? And he's afraid. He doesn't want to do it. And so Saul has to fall on his own sword. And then the armor bearer falls on his sword. So far, so good. Saul can't control the people that are around him, even his own armor bearer, even in the midst of war. That's not a place that you want to be. If you ever get an armor bearer, always make sure that they actually do what you want, right? Here's a very similar type of scene, right? So David calls over one of his young men. He says, strike him down. And notice, there's none of this, oh, I'm afraid. No, he strikes him down. As soon as David tells people to do things, they do things. So the servant struck the Amalekite down, and he died. And then David, speaking to the corpse, interestingly enough, he speaks to the corpse and he says, your blood is on your own head, which is a Hebrew idiom, obviously, duh. Clearly it is. But it's a Hebrew idiom meaning that this is justified. This is, we have a phrase, right, in English, an idiom. You made your own bed,
yeah.
Right? Now you have to lie in it, right? That's the same type of thing. Your blood is on your own head. It's that same type of thing, right? And therefore, this isn't unjust. This is you brought this on yourself. That's the way I would translate that. You brought this on yourself, right? David said to the Amalekite, because your own mouth testified against you when you admitted, I killed the Lord's anointed. Pay attention. Did the young man say, I killed the Lord's anointed?
No, David did.
No. What did the young man say? I killed Saul. Notice what David has done. Is that David has taken, not that scene, but this little scene. The Amalekite thinks that this is a story about him, about David, and about Saul. The Amalekite kills Saul, which says something about the Amalekite's relationship with David. Notice what David has done. David hasn't mentioned, let's see, let me just make sure this is right. David doesn't mention Saul's name at all, because it's not about Saul. Well, it is about Saul, but it's not really about Saul. What it's about is about the Lord's anointed. Why does David have the Amalekite killed?
Because if you can kill Saul, you can kill me.
I'm going to click my heels. Yes, because it's not about Saul. It's about the Lord's anointed. Right? And if we're going to set a precedent of that, if there's something about the Lord's anointed that you don't like, and you can kill the Lord's anointed, then who's the Lord's anointed now? And therefore, you can kill the Lord's anointed. And David doesn't want the Lord's anointed to be killed. And therefore, that's the reason why. Again, just notice it's not about Saul, it's about the Lord's anointed. David changes the significance of the event. So it has nothing to do with Saul. It has to do with the office. It's almost like he's playing chess. So far, you know what I'm talking about? It's almost like he's playing chess and he's paying attention because he already has a bunch of people around him that as soon as he does this, they do that. Your own mouth testified against you when you admitted, I killed the Lord's anointed. Then David sang this funeral song for Saul and his son Jonathan. David ordered everyone in Judah to learn this song. It's called the Song of the Bow, you know, like a bow, not like a bow. But a bow, so obviously war. In fact, it's written in the scroll from Yashar. We have no idea who this is. But, and here's a nice poem, and we're running out of time. I'm just going to read this through. I'm not going to comment on it, but here's a nice little song. Alas, Israel, your prince lies dead on your heights. Look how the mighty warriors have fallen. Don't tell about it in Gath, which is a Philistine town. Don't tell about it in Gath. Don't bring the news of it to Ashkelon streets, or else the Philistines' daughters will rejoice. The daughters of the uncircumcised will celebrate. Ah, you hills of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain on you, and no fields yielding grain offerings, because it was there that the mighty warrior's shield was defiled, the shield of Saul, never again anointed with oil. Jonathan's bow never wavered from the blood of the slain, from the gore of the warriors. Never did Saul's sword return empty. Okay, I'll just... It's kind of interesting because Saul has tried to kill David a few times. In fact, if Saul's sword had never returned empty, David wouldn't be around to sing this song. Which is going to bring up a question that I'll just ask at the very end. Saul and Jonathan, so well loved, so dearly cherished. In their lives and in their deaths, they were never separated. They were faster than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Daughters of Israel, weep over Saul. He dressed you in crimson with jewels. He decorated your clothes with gold jewelry. Look how the mighty warriors have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan lies dead on your heights. I grieve for you, my brother Jonathan. You were so dear to me. Your love was more amazing to me than the love of women. Look how the mighty warriors have fallen. Look how the weapons of war have been destroyed.
It's rewriting history.
Oh, how? How?
He just made a new narrative.
Exactly.
You know,
like,
kill my brother.
These people. And again, those of you who are with us in this... I mean, Saul.
But Jonathan.
And Jonathan, that's right.
But Jonathan.
And the thing with Jonathan, yeah, it's a funny thing, is that the text always makes very clear that Jonathan loves David. It never says at all what David thinks about Jonathan.
Yeah.
Jonathan's willing to lay down his life for David. It's never clear at all whether David's willing to lay down his life for Jonathan. It's very clear that Jonathan's willing to do anything to see that David is crowned king. And David seems to be quite happy with that. Jonathan's willing to do anything. And it seems as though David lets him. Just one tiny little thing, right? Because it's a famous line, right? You were so dear to me. Your love was more amazing to me than the love of women. You understand that's an ambiguous line, right? Because it's not the love of you. My love of you was more than love of women. Or is it your love for me was more than love of women? Why is he rewriting history? Why this song that seems to elevate these people almost to the place of gods?
Because now he's in that place.
Huh? Yeah.
Because now he's in that place.
Now he's in that place, exactly. And, you see, if you go to 3 funerals, you've seen this before, right? Mm-hmm. The old buzzard, right? He's finally dead. Finally dead. He finally kicked the bucket.
Yeah.
Finally. Oh my God, we couldn't wait. And then we get up and we eulogize. Oh God. Oh, Uncle Sam, I miss you so much. When all we're waiting is on the will, right? Right. You again, right?
Good point.
Sometime later, David questioned the Lord, "Should I go to one of the towns in Judah?" "Yes, go," the Lord told him. "Which one should I go to?" David asked. "To Hebron," the Lord replied. And so David went down there along with his two wives, Ahinoam from Jezreel and Abigail, Nabal's widow from Carmel. Just notice it's Nabal's widow. Nabal was one of these people that stood against David. And you can tell just from the story itself what happened to Nabal. David gets to where they were, Abigail. David also took the soldiers who were with him, each from his family, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And then the people of Judah came to Hebron, and they anointed, again, David king over the house of Judah. When David was informed that it was the people of Jabesh-Gilead who had buried Saul, you remember that? The people of Jabesh-Gilead come. He sent messengers to the people of Jabesh-Gilead. "The Lord bless you," he said to them, "for doing this loyal deed for your master Saul by burying him. May the Lord now show you loyal love and faithfulness. I myself will also reward you because you did this. So now take courage and be brave. Yes, your master Saul is dead. But the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." Okay, maybe I overread that a little bit at the end. But yes, your master Saul is dead, but the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. They showed faithfulness to Saul. So why is David sort of going out of his way to entreat Jabesh-Gilead? Yes, because they were faithful. But
they weren't afraid to raid the Israelites.
That's right. Yeah. So they showed faithfulness to Saul. So who is Saul? Was Saul David's enemy? Well, it's complicated now. David has complicated that little thing. If we read this at the end of 1 Samuel, is he David's enemy? He's tried to kill him a few times. Maybe, right? But now the story is being pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? The story is being rewritten, right? And now, obviously, the people at Jabesh-Gilead, do they like Saul? They love Saul. They're willing to do anything for Saul, including go in by night and take his body and give him a proper burial. Well, if they're so interested in Saul, what do they think about David? So what he's trying to get, what do we call this? Getting consensus, shall we?
Consolidating power.
Consolidating power. Oh, you're going to enjoy the next few Sundays, yes. "The house of Judah has anointed me king over them. Meanwhile," oh, see, but things aren't so simple. Meanwhile, it's just like Breaking Bad. Abner, Ner's son, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, Saul's son. See, we got Jonathan, we got Abinadab, we got Malchishua, but there's also Ishbosheth that nobody mentioned. So he has another son. And obviously, when the king dies, the new king is going to be a son, right? Patrilineal, right? Monarchy. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and there he made him king over Gilead, the Geshurites, Jezreel, Ephraim, and Benjamin, over all Israel. So we got Israel, and we got Judah. David's the king over Judah. Seems as though now Ishbosheth is the king over Israel. And Saul's son Ishbosheth was years old. In Hebrew, there's no number there, interestingly enough. And so it's actually a translation from Hebrew. It's not a misprint here. We don't know how old he was when he began to reign, which is kind of interesting because it reads very differently if he's 6, if he's 12, if he's 22, if he's 35. It's a very different type of story, right? But I don't know. Saul's son Ishbosheth was so many years old when he became king over Israel, and he ruled for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. The amount of time David ruled in Hebron over the house of Judah totaled 7.5 years. Wait, that's the end? Why is it only 2 years and then 7? What happens for the rest of those 5.5 years? Come back next week. There you go. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.